Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for all UK-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we'll explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm sure many of you listening will have had a patient call and say they want an appointment because suddenly they can't see. But what can't they see? Is it complete vision loss or do they just have some blur? And how do you go about deciding upon the urgency? If the vision loss has an underlying cause, how do you access effective care in the most efficient way? Today, we'll be answering these questions and more. To do this, we've come to Manchester.
My time is in a few moments. I'm arriving into Manchester Piccadilly. Please do that. Can I leave us?
More specifically, we're at the Manchester Royal Eye Hospital, and we're here to meet A&E optometrists Helen Wilson and Amanda Harding.
Hi, I'm Helen Wilson, and I am lead optometrist at Manchester Royal Eye Hospital in the emergency eye department.
Hello there, my name's Amanda Harding. I'm lead optometrist for glaucoma here at Manchester Eye Hospital, and I mostly work in the glaucoma clinics with the odd session in the emergency eye department.
So I'm very pleased to be here with you both today. Before we start discussing the clinical assessment and referral pathway mechanisms, I think it's important to hear what sudden loss of vision feels like from a patient's perspective. So let's meet the third person in the room and the second, Helen. Thanks for joining us, Helen. Can you tell us who you are and what happened to your eye?
My name's Helen, and I used to be an ophthalmic imaging specialist here at the Eye Hospital, and I retired 2017. And a month after I retired, I went to bed on a Saturday evening. I was bending over to take my shoes off, and when I raised my head up, I realised, well, there's something wrong with my left eye. I couldn't see anything. I rubbed it and blinked, and I was actually aware that my vision was slowly deteriorating. I could only see with the lower part of my eye, and the upper part of my eye was sort of filling in with black bits. You know, it took me into a state of panic. So having a bit of knowledge about eye conditions, I had a feeling that I was having an occlusion. It was frightening. I was really scared. And I thought I'd have to get to A&E quickly to see if they can stop it, you know, unblock it, if that's what it was.
So after you noticed that something was wrong, what did you do?
Well, I got to A&E as quickly as I could. And I know you haven't got a lot of time if the blockage can be undone. But I saw a triage nurse who then quite quickly got me to see the A&E doctor. And I explained to him what was happening and that he said, I think I need to get you to have a CAT scan. What the A&E doctor did was what he thought was best, which was probably was the right outcome, was to get me to have a CAT scan because what was going on in my eye was quite likely to be going on in my brain as well.
Yeah. So when did you eventually see an ophthalmologist?
It was the following day. The A&E doctor spoke to the ophthalmologist on call, and he came back down and said to me, he just wants me to do some tests. And he waved his fingers about around my head to see if I could see certain areas. And then that's when I became aware of just how much visual loss I'd got.
And did they tell you how likely you were to recover your vision?
They said I would never recover that vision.
That must have been quite a blow to you.
It was. I'd had scans as well and I'd had photographs taken and they could see this embolus lodged on my optic nerve head and they could actually use the different viewing systems on the machines to see the different layers of the eye to see what had actually been damaged by the lack of blood to those areas and where the ischemia had taken the vision away. And they said, unfortunately, that's never going to come back. So, you know, my vision wasn't impaired whatsoever, apart from the visual loss of the bit that was dead.
Yeah. So we know that there was no recovery to that particular area of your visual field. But what can you see now?
If I cover up my right eye and I look at you, I can't see your left eye and the top of your head, but I can see everything else.
So on a clock face, it'd go from maybe 1 o'clock backwards to about 8 o'clock, wouldn't it?
I can't see 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. I can't see 4 o'clock and a little bit of 11 o'clock. What's really strange is the area that's occluded. I've got all these, it looks like little hieroglyphics. I couldn't even draw them. They're like, it's like an alien language. It's really weird. And if I shut that eye, they'll also appear in this eye. It doesn't stop the vision. It's just a phenomenon from that area of damaged cells.
And how does it affect your everyday life?
Well, it doesn't. I was really concerned that I wasn't going to be able to drive. And then as I was having follow-ups with the ophthalmologist, the eye hospital, they were looking for things like neovascularization. They were looking for rubiosis in my iris, things like that. And none of that, touch wood, had happened. So I think I more or less adjusted to it after that reassurance that this was it, this is what you're left with, just get on with it. Because, you know, what had happened had happened. What I was left with was the fact that I could still use both eyes to read with. I could still drive, you know. At the time, it was just really, really frightening, thinking, is it going to get any worse? And I needed that reassurance.
Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Let's bring in the optometrists now, Helen Wilson and Amanda Harding. You both heard Helen's story and both work in A&E here in Manchester. So how often do patients present to you with a painless, sudden loss of vision?
So artery occlusions are not that common. It's quite a rare event. However, when we do see them in our emergency eye department, they do tend to self-present because they know, just as in Helen's case, that there is something seriously wrong with them because they suddenly can't see at all in that eye. And it's a very profound loss of vision. It's normally down to about they can only just see the hand movement or count the number of fingers in front of them and nothing else. And it's one eye. And they tend to have, like Helen did, she could see it kind of coming down from the top in her case, but it's that profound loss of vision, which normally comes on over like a space of few seconds, really. So when we do get them into our emergency eye department, we triage them as red, so they go straight through because time is of the essence. It is a ticking clock. Although the on-call ophthalmologist will be consulted, as in Helen's case, but actually the A&E doctor, quite rightly, is concerned that actually, is this a sign of a stroke that she's having? Is this life-threatening? But certainly in our emergency eye department, when we see these patients, we want to confirm, yes, it definitely is an artery occlusion. We would always check pupil reactions at triage. So anybody who presents with a profound loss of vision gets an ROPD check, and there would be a positive relative afferent pupil defect.
What would we see if someone has an arterial occlusion when we're looking at the fundus?
The retina itself would look very pale due to the retinal ischemia. You get the swelling of the inner layers of the retina, except for over the fovea, where you would see this classic sign of a cherry red spot. And that's because the retina itself is supplied by the central artery, but over the fovea, there's no retinal nerve fibre layer, so no nerve fibres, and you can see through to the choroid. So that's supplied by the posterior ciliary arteries, which supply the choroid. So that's why you can still see the circulation on the fovea. That's why you have this classic cherry red spot. Some patients are very lucky. They have what we call a ciliaretinal artery. About 25% of people have this. And again, the ciliaretinal artery arises directly from the choroid or from one of the posterior ciliary arteries, providing additional alternative blood supply to the retina, meaning that they can normally retain a better level of central vision. So the prognosis is a little bit better for them.
With Helen, she had a branch arterial occlusion, didn't she? So how does that differ in its signs and what she would have seen?
Yeah, so in a branch artery occlusion, it's affecting obviously not the central artery. And you normally get the embolus on the optic nerve head with the central ones. But for the branch artery occlusion, it would be just more of the, you know, once the arterial has entered the retina. And normally you can get these little emboli where the arteries branch because the arterial is slightly narrower there. And that's where these emboli can lodge. There are different types of emboli, actually, that we can see when we look at these branch artery occlusions. lesions. So you can get kind of refractile cholesterol emboli, or what we call Hollenhurst plaques, which come from the carotid artery. And certainly that's one of the tests that the ophthalmologist or the medical team might want to do, is a carotid Doppler to check the arterial supply. You could also get calcific plaques, which look white, and they tend to come from diseased cardiac valves. So hence cardiology may be involved to find out if there's anything wrong with the heart. You can also get platelet fibrin plaques, which normally are associated with atherosclerosis. But in actual fact, when I've read the literature, branch vein artery occlusions sometimes can go unnoticed. They might be completely asymptomatic, especially if it's just a very small arterial in a peripheral part of the retina. You know, we don't go around checking our peripheral vision all the time. So potentially it could be picked up in primary care optometry by an optometrist doing a routine sight test.
And what can cause these type of occlusions that you've mentioned? Is it related to lifestyle or medical problems?
Yeah, certainly there are risk factors for this. Certainly the older we are, the more at risk we are. So usually over 60s, interestingly more common in men than in women. If there's a history of carotid artery disease or heart disease, any diabetes or hypertension as well. Certainly there's links as well with a history of intravenous drug use or pregnancy. But the other thing that we need to check for is, has this arterial occlusion associated with giant cell arteritis? And there is certainly a link. So whenever we see patients in our emergency eye department, we certainly do some blood tests for inflammatory markers to check.
So the patient in the case study, who's also called Helen, presented herself to A&E, and that's probably because she worked at the hospital before and she understood that it was an emergency. She knew what to do. But a lot of patients may not realise that. So if they don't use A&E as their first port of call and they turn up at the community optometrist practice, what should that optometrist do?
Well, you would hope that they would recognise the red flag symptoms of an artery occlusion, and you would hope that their reception staff are prepped on patients who present, just as they are with patients who say they've got flashes and floaters. You would think that a sudden profound loss of vision is an indication that there's something serious going on here, and actually that patient shouldn't be waiting for an appointment. They should actually be directed straight to A&E, because basically time is sight. And obviously if there's other signs, neurological signs of stroke, for example, so, you know, slurred speech, limb weakness, then again, straight to A&E for those patients.
So what are the treatment options once the stroke team has released the patient to ophthalmology?
Unfortunately, there's no clinically proven treatment for central retinal artery occlusion, although several therapies have been proposed and are used by clinicians. So they think blowing into a paper bag to increase carbon dioxide concentration, basically an attempt to dilate the retinal arteries to try and get the clot to dislodge or the embolus to dislodge, and ocular massage as well with a, you know, your thumb on your eye to try and again dislodge the clot, because they think that the oscillations in intraocular pressure will help to dislodge it. And basically, yeah, lowering the intraocular pressure with medication. So Helena said that she had an injection, and that was of acetazolamide to try and reduce the intraocular pressure. And also there is a procedure called a paracentesis, where basically a small gauge needle is inserted into the anterior chamber to try and release a bit of the fluid. But all these are attempts to reduce the intraocular pressure to try to dislodge that embolus and move it further down the arteriole. But like I say, none of this is proven, and it has to be done within, they say, about 4 to 6 hours of the presentation of symptoms. Unfortunately, the prognosis isn't great for these. And Helen did say, you know, she's permanently lost that superior part of her visual field. Yeah. And unfortunately, that can happen. And Helen was lucky that it was just a branch occlusion rather than a central occlusion.
So Helen, when you receive a referral from the community optometrist who may suspect a vascular incident or may have seen an embolus on the retina, what would you like that optometrist to include in their referral?
We have had referrals through from community optometrists. A patient may have attended for a routine sight test and they've picked up that actually there's a little embolus on one of the arteries. Now, the patient may be completely asymptomatic and didn't know anything about it. And certainly in this world where, you know, there's a lot more imaging going on in the community, they're easier to spot. Basically, we'd want to know whether the patient has any symptoms. So have they had any symptoms of transient visual loss, for example, so symptoms of amaurosis fugax? Have they had any kind of visual disturbances? We would also want to know their general health as well. You know, do they have those risk factors? Are they diabetic? Are they hypertensive? What medication are they on already? Are they on antiplatelet therapy already? And if they're a smoker?
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. And to help us guide our future content, we want to hear from you. If there's a topic you want us to cover or have a fascinating case you want to share, email us. The address is podcast@docket.info, or you can tweet us at Sound Optometry. Today, I'm at Manchester Royal Eye Hospital with optometrists Amanda Harding and Helen Wilson to discuss what to do if a patient experiences a sudden loss of vision. Amanda, we just heard all about artery occlusion. What are the key signs that would indicate a vein occlusion rather than an artery occlusion?
Vein occlusions, firstly, are much more common and much more likely to present to an optometrist in the high street, because their vision is likely to be more gradual loss. So they can lose vision quite suddenly, but it won't be as sudden as an artery occlusion, and it won't be total vision loss. So it can be anywhere from a small amount of reduced vision, sort of 6.9, 6.12, down to less than 6.60 in sort of severe cases. And it also depends on how much of the retina is involved and whether there is ischemia and whether the macula becomes edematous or not. So there's quite a lot of things that can cause the symptoms to be different depending on how bad the vein occlusion is. But it's certainly a lot more likely to present to a high street optometrist. A central retinal vein occlusion will, you know, it will cause a loss of vision. It will reduce the vision, but it won't happen quite as suddenly. And the patients may wait a few days before contacting anyone because they might think, oh, that'll come back. Or it's because it's not that absolute sudden black vision or a shutter coming across the vision.
So it's not quite so profound, the vision loss. But when an optometrist does see this in practice, what do you think their response should be? What action should they take?
So they need to do a full assessment. So you obviously need visual acuity. You definitely need to do a pressure check, because depending on when the vein occlusion's happened, if it's actually been a while ago, they may have started getting ischemia and they may start to get neovascularization of the iris, which can then lead to a raise in pressure and neovascular glaucoma. So pressure is really important to take. And then obviously have a good look at the fundus to see what's going on. They're fairly obvious. You probably can see them undilated in many cases, unless there's really profound cataract or something in the way. So you should be able to pick up that there is a vein occlusion there. And again, with these patients, it's actually their general health that you're more worried about actually than their eye health. Initially, when they first present to you, you should be sending them straight to their GP for an urgent vascular workup. The eye needs looking at, but doesn't need looking at that day. It's not an emergency.
So it's straight to the GP rather than straight to A&E?
Yes, definitely.
So Helen has already told us about what to look out for if someone has an arterial occlusion when we're looking at the fundus. What would we see if we looked at a fundus that's had a central vein occlusion or a branch vein occlusion?
So a central retinal vein occlusion, you're going to see tortuous blood vessels. Depending on the severity of it, you may get disc swelling because there's fluid building up. You're going to get cotton wool spots and multiple hemorrhages. You may even see some swelling at the macula without even an OCT if it's quite severe and the vision's quite reduced. And then if it's a branch retinal vein occlusion, obviously the optic nerve will probably look okay, depending on where the branch is, because it could be a hemiretinal vein occlusion, which is like half of the retina. But you're going to see those cotton wool spots and hemorrhages and tortuous blood vessels in a part of the retina rather than obviously the whole of the retina. And again, the vision may not be as affected as much, although they still can have some fluid at the macula.
You mentioned macular edema. A lot of optometrists now have OCT in practice. So if they were to see a macular edema, would that change the way they refer the patient? Would they still refer to the GP, or would you recommend that they refer to their local hospital?
So they still need to refer to the GP first, but depending on where you are working, you'll probably have some kind of emergency or rapid access macular clinic that you can send these patients through, like you would a wet macular degeneration. So if they've got a lot of CMO and reduced vision, they need to be seen fairly soon by the medical retina team. It doesn't have to be absolutely that day, but in the next few days, you want them to be seen. If there's not much vision involvement and there doesn't appear to be any macular edema, then it can be a little bit less quick, and maybe a normal medical retina appointment to be seen within 2 to 4 weeks would be sufficient.
So apart from vascular causes, what else can cause sudden loss of vision?
We alluded to this before when patients present with an artery occlusion, and the thing that we check for is giant cell arteritis. So that can present with a sudden reduction in visual acuity in only less than 660. The symptoms can be a little bit wishy-washy sometimes. They don't always have the classic symptoms. So the classic symptoms of a giant cell arteritis would be kind of your pain and scalp tenderness, particularly if somebody's brushing their hair, they feel it's all tender. They would have this symptom called jaw claudication, where when they're eating, it gets progressively more painful and harder to chew. They might have some visual symptoms. So they might have symptoms of diplopia or transient loss of vision or transient blurring of vision. But it's not always clear cut. So there are some guidelines actually from the British Society of Rheumatologists, which suggests when you're trying to diagnose GCA is you want to do bloods. You can also refer them for a temporal artery ultrasound, which is non-invasive, but there can be an invasive temporal artery biopsy as well, which is a definitive diagnosis of a GCA. And those patients, they are an emergency. They're both sight and life-threatening, and they are normally admitted into our emergency eye department. So if you have somebody who you suspect has GCA or what we call an arteritic ischemic optic neuropathy, so there would maybe be a relative afferent pupil defect present and the disc might look a bit swollen, they might have an altitudinal visual field defect that's come on suddenly. That's another indicator of an AION. So those patients, again, you need to identify those red flags and advise them to attend their A&E as an emergency as well. And they normally get admitted for intravenous methylprednisolone, followed by high-dose steroids, tapering over about 12 to 18 months. But it's another one that's tricky, and it's essential that it is identified for the patient.
I know what you mean when you say tricky, because I had a patient that presented for a cataract assessment with reduced vision, and she'd been referred by her optometrist, and I didn't actually think the cataract was that severe, and I did think that her disc did look a bit pale. But you know, these things are never clear cut, are they? And I asked her why she felt that she needed to have the cataract surgery. And she said, well, my vision is definitely worse, but she said also my glasses are causing me some problems. They really hurt the side of my head. But she didn't have all the classic signs, and she'd had this tenderness on the side of her head for a while. So I basically referred her back to her GP as an emergency, and she was investigated straight away for, you know, temporal arteritis. But as you say, it's sometimes very difficult to know what to do when they don't have all the symptoms. We all know the textbook symptoms. We expect to have them all, and you think, well, that's easy. If we've got these, I'll send them to casualty. But often when they just have one or two things and it's not always clear cut and there's co-pathologies, it can be a real struggle to decide what to do.
The other symptoms they can have is some sort of mild fatigue and some weight loss as well, and just generally not feeling very well, like a malaise that can go with it, and they don't necessarily have the classic sort of headaches.
Absolutely. And they tends to be the older population. You know, you're not going to get this in a 25-year-old with headaches. It is definitely a condition of old age.
And of course, apart from vascular incidents and giant cell arteritis, there are medical retinal causes of a sudden loss of vision as well. So we probably won't go into those in too much depth, but could you just briefly mention what those are?
Well, obviously the classic is a retinal detachment, but that would come on in a slightly different way. And obviously there's the classic symptoms for a retinal detachment, which everyone is aware of. Although you could lose your vision quite quickly, it's not going to be sudden like an artery occlusion. And obviously if it's a true retinal detachment and it's completely detached and the macula is detached, obviously they're going to have a severe loss of vision, but it will have come on maybe over hours or days. And obviously you would see that when you looked in. I always want to reassure people that retinal detachments, when they're actually truly there and there's a proper retinal detachment, you will see them. They are very obvious. It's the tears and holes that are a bit more tricky. The other one we get a lot of in the emergency eye department is vitreous hemorrhage, because that does cause profound loss of vision as well. But there's normally a really good underlying reason why someone might have a vitreous hemorrhage. So they're nearly always diabetic or have some other known vascular issue. So actually vein occlusions sometimes get vitreous hemorrhages as well. And you can't see anything when you look in. That's the other classic. But it's not a retinal detachment. You just don't see anything. It's this like sort of red haze of nothingness and you can't see the back of the eye. But again, they will have very, very profound loss of vision.
So Helen, if an optometrist does see an embolus on the fundus and they're not sure if it's a new one or perhaps it's one that's been there for a while, how do you tell, what do you do about it?
So first of all, you need to make sure, well, is it an embolus? Because sometimes we have seen cases where it's been a camera artifact. So if you do see it on a retinal fundus photograph, always double check with your vault lens or your ophthalmoscope just to make sure it is there. And it will always be on an arteriole. And more commonly where the arterioles branch, because that's where they're slightly thinner. So you'll normally see it on a branch. If it's a fresh one, it might have the occlusion like after it, so that area of retina will look white. And if it's an old one, then it's really tricky because the retina might go back to looking normal. If you did an OCT scan, you would see that the area that was affected would be kind of area of atrophy, so it'd be thinner on the OCT scan. But it's all to do with the symptoms as well. And the history, you know, has the patient reported that this has happened to them in the past? Do they have a visual field defect that correlates to where the embolus is as well?
So having a photographic image would be a really good way forward, wouldn't it, to be able to record where it is on that day and then perhaps check it again in the future?
Absolutely. And if you have got the facility to send photographs to your secondary care provider, then it's a really good thing to attach any photographs that you have. And not just of the photograph of the eye that's affected, but the other eye as well. We always like to see both eyes when we're at this end triaging so that we've got a comparator.
What would make triaging better, do you think?
So if they do see these patients with this embolus and they don't have any symptoms, then actually what they need to be doing is thinking about, well, actually, this patient needs a cardiovascular workup. And the best person to do that is their GP. So they should be thinking more along the lines of, well, actually, they do need ophthalmology referral, but it could go through to a medical retina clinic as an urgency within about 2 to 4 weeks. But actually, they also need that GP cardiovascular workup as well. Obviously, if they're symptomatic and they have symptoms of amaurosis fugax, then they need to be going on to a TIA or stroke pathway as well. So that would be a more urgent one, and that would be to your A&E again or your stroke service, depending on your pathways in your area.
Thank you. So Amanda, a patient is likely to be very anxious if they've had an occlusion in the past or if they've got symptoms of one that's currently happening to them. What advice would you give to optometrists when it comes to communicating with patients in these situations?
Well, I think optometrists are used to dealing with patients where you've got to tell them quite difficult pieces of information. You know, this happens in high street as well as in hospital about people's vision may not meet driving standards or things like that that you've got to communicate to a patient. So it's really about showing empathy to a patient that, you know, you understand that it's very scary, but you're going to refer them to the right people. You know, you can't promise anything. The vein occlusion, yes, that's treatable, but an artery occlusion, there isn't necessarily going to be a vision regained. But really, that's not what you're about as the high street optometrist. You're about getting them to see the right people. And then it's our job then to inform them that they might not get their vision back, I think. So you probably want to avoid that because actually you want to get them safely as quickly as possible to the emergency practitioner for their possible stroke or their eye problem rather than really worrying about the vision. I know the vision is why they've presented, but actually you're actually more worried about their life rather than their eye.
Yes. So it's about communicating it correctly so they know what the emphasis is on.
Yeah.
Amanda Harding, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
And thank you, Helen Wilson.
Thank you, Michelle.
If you would like more information on this topic, go to our website, docket.info, and search for sound optometry and check out the additional reading materials. Don't forget that by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain 1 CPD point, covering the GOC domains of professionalism and clinical practice. We'll be back next month to explore another topic that matters to optometrists around the country. Until then, we'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.